Any questions anyone would like to bring up from discussion groups? Yeah.
I have it written down, but I can't find it. So here's the question from our group. On the discussion of compassion, it seemed like there was a lot of discussion about intentions, about compassion fatigue. But are there any practical suggestions on effective compassionate practice for people like us?
Okay. So again, a couple of points important. One is that if we want to expand compassion out to others, then it's quite important, of course, to have compassion for ourselves, to feel good about ourselves. Because if we're not feeling good about ourselves, it's going to be very difficult to extend it out to others. So that's sort of one point. We need to often start with ourselves, because unfortunately in our modern society, many of us are not feeling so good about ourselves, you know. So that's where we need to start. And then, of course, the key, or one key with practical compassionate activity, is the wisdom factor, to make sure that we are always including the wisdom factor in our compassionate activities. And of course, wisdom can come at many levels. I mean, just wisdom in terms of not being biased, wisdom in terms of knowing what to do, what not to do to try to help. And of course, at a deeper level, the wisdom is this not grasping onto this me and them, you know, this sort of separation. So that's, of course, at a deeper level. And I think, again, when we talk about compassionate activities, it's very important to also put effort in cultivating these attitudes in meditation. Because otherwise, if we try to simply in a practical way help others, often our self-cherishing and our mental afflictions sort of get in the way of that. So I think it's important to engage in both those aspects in terms of developing that compassionate attitude in meditation, and then, of course, implementing that in daily life. And again, I've mentioned many times, but again, to really avoid this cognitive fusion, you know, in the way we think and the way we speak, particularly when we start dealing with difficult people, if we really do this cognitive fusion, I think it's going to be very difficult to cultivate compassion for these people who tend to behave not in a very good way. And then, of course, in terms of helping others, we need to understand that we can't make people a certain way, and not to try and force things onto people, you know, because otherwise they're just going to react to that. So again, that's a little bit the wisdom factor in terms of trying to help, to understand how to help people without forcing onto people. So I think that's some aspects that we can work on. And again, to work on this compassion in stages. So if we're really not feeling good about ourselves, then start there, and then really work with people close to us, and then start to work with people that we don't know so well, and then start to work with difficult people. I think from the very beginning, if we tackle those one or two people or whoever that we really have a lot of problem with, I think we're going to be overwhelmed and we're not going to be able to do it. So really to work on it in a very step-by-step manner, I think that's going to be the best approach. Anything else from discussion group? Let's continue on then where we left off. So, of course, now we are looking at the six perfections. The six perfections are the core practices that will enable us to achieve the goal of enlightenment. So remember, the entry point to the Mahayana path is when we cultivate this aspiration of bodhicitta, the aspiration for enlightenment for the benefit of others. But what we need to remember, of course, is that bodhicitta is not just the entry point into the Mahayana path, it's the central pillar, central support of the Mahayana path. That all of our activities here are to be supported by this aspiration. And that's what actually makes, for example, generosity the perfection of generosity. The perfection of generosity is generosity that is supported and sustained by the bodhicitta motivation. And that was one of those six supremacies that we looked at, that we should try to make sure that these practices are supported by this bodhicitta motivation. And so we're looking at these six perfections, which also, of course, can be subsumed into the three higher trainings. That generosity, ethics, and patience can be subsumed within ethics. Then we have the concentration and the wisdom, and the joyous effort is something we need to apply to all three. So we're talking about essentially the same three core areas of practice. And so far then, we've been looking at the first three of those, that is generosity, ethics, and patience. And so we have a little bit to go in terms of patience. So if we go to page 29, we saw that patience here can be with respect to three things. There is patience in terms of not reacting to harm done to us, to have this very calm, clear mind in the face of a difficult situation. And the second patience we're trying to develop is this patience of accepting suffering. So again, patience of accepting suffering doesn't mean just sit there and don't do anything if we're suffering. What it means is not to react to that suffering with aversion. And of course, if we can overcome the suffering, we overcome it. And if we can't overcome it, then at least don't develop aversion to it so that we magnify the amount of suffering we experience. And we saw in that section as well is that these suffering experiences are actually often can really bring us a lot of benefit. We can learn from the suffering experiences in a number of ways, and we saw there the five qualities of suffering. Of course, we're not suggesting that we need to go out and look for suffering, but what we're suggesting here is that if we happen to be in a situation of suffering, we can learn and benefit from that experience in those five ways. And so now we're going to look at the last of the three types of patience at the bottom of page 29, and that is, it says here, the patience of certitude about the teachings. And so this is talking about the patience of the difficulties that we face in developing conviction in the various teachings and practices that we engage in here. So this is what we see in the first line. The patience of certitude about the teachings means generating the forbearance of conviction. And it talks about eight different aspects of the practice. But basically, again, what we're talking about here is to have the patience of really developing certitude or conviction about the various aspects of the practice. So, of course, some of these aspects of practice are not so easy to understand and come to realize, and so we are to have this patience, this forbearance in terms of coming to develop conviction about all of these various areas of practice. So this is the third type of patience that we are to develop here in the perfection of patience. So that will then complete the third of the six perfections, that of patience. Any questions about that before we move on to the fourth one? So the fourth one here on the top of the next page we see is the perfection of, here it's translated as joyous perseverance. Sometimes also this is translated as joyous effort. So again, let's look at how this is defined, this perfection. It's the first line there, it says, when you have focused upon something virtuous, joyous perseverance is enthusiasm for it. So joyous perseverance is effectively a mind that delights in virtue, a mind that is happy to do good things. So here, you know, we need to make sure that we understand this well, because otherwise, you know, we talk about in general, we need to put effort into something to accomplish some goal. But often then we see that effort, or we see the spiritual practice in particular, as some sort of hardship that we have to endure. So here we need to understand that we need to have a joyful mind in these practices, even if they're difficult, is to really understand the benefits of the practice and then take joy in it. And so that is really a lot what this is about, is through understanding the benefits, then developing joy in our effort in working with these practices. Otherwise, we're going to see spiritual practice as a hardship, and then we've sort of missed the point. And then we're going to end up in laziness, which we're going to look at very shortly. But first, let's look at the three types of joyous perseverance. Here, the first one says armor-like joyous perseverance. And this is really about sort of setting the motivation, or at the beginning, to really armor ourselves with this attitude that of joyously persevering. So maybe we can read what it says there. It says, the armor of being undaunted is the inexhaustible armor. If you can generate a single attitude such as this, you easily complete limitless accumulations and purify measureless obscurations. This becomes the most excellent cause for never turning back. By just being joyful, no matter how long it takes, you quickly become a Buddha. So again, this is what we are to do here. And this is what we're going to look at in the next section, talking about unfavorable conditions. So maybe we can leave it to there. Let's briefly mention the next two first. So the second is the joyous perseverance of gathering virtue, which is simply, as it's mentioned here, is engaging in the virtuous actions of a bodhisattva. Of course, we're talking here about the six perfections. And then the third one is the joyous perseverance of acting for the welfare of living beings, which again is talking about then engaging in actions to help others in terms of various activities. Here it mentions the 11 activities, and I think somewhere in the text it mentions what the 11 are, but off the top of my head I can't remember what they are, but it is mentioned somewhere in the text here. So let's now have a look at two things here. It says here that there are two aspects in terms of in having this joyous perseverance. Is we first need to eliminate unfavorable conditions that prevent the joyous effort, and then over the page, at the top of page 31, near the top, talking about gathering the forces of the favorable conditions. So what are the unfavorable conditions that interfere with or prevent joyous perseverance? And then what are the things that we can do to provide conducive conditions for joyous perseverance? So here, if we look at the factors incompatible or the unfavorable conditions, in the first line there, it says, there are two factors incompatible with entering the path, and they are not entering even though you see that you can do the practice, and two, not entering because you become discouraged thinking, how can I do such a practice? And then it says, with the first factor, there's two possibilities. You have the laziness of procrastination thinking there is still time. And second, you are not procrastinating, but you are overwhelmed by your attachment to inferior and common activities. So here we're talking about three types of laziness. So the first, if we look in the list here, there is the laziness of procrastination, which is simply putting things off, that, you know, I can do this later. And if we read the comment here, it's basically saying that to overcome this, you know, we've already seen the solution to this much earlier in the Lamrim, and that is to reflect on precious human life and death, to really reflect that we've got this wonderful opportunity and it's not going to last forever. And so if we can really reflect on those, then we're going to really overcome this laziness of procrastination of simply putting things off till a later time. Then, of course, the second type of laziness is, here it calls, attachment to ignoble activities. And what this is, of course, is a laziness in terms of just getting caught up in mundane concerns, you know, the eight worldly concerns. And so here we are to reflect that this approach, that chasing after the eight worldly concerns, is not really going to get us happiness and overcome suffering, and that it's only if we really develop our mind and look inside of ourselves that we are going to achieve that goal. So therefore, it talks here about to understand that these teachings are going to be the source of happiness and not some sort of external activities. And therefore, we can stop the laziness of simply getting caught up in a lot of worldly concerns that really don't bring us much at all. And then, of course, there's the third type of laziness here, and that is of discouragement or self-contempt. Again, sort of this is the one where often this comes with the cognitive fusion, you know, thinking, oh, I can't do that, I'm no good, I don't have the ability to do that, I'm weak, I'm hopeless, and so forth. So here again, to overcome that, one, we need to stop identifying ourselves with any negative aspects of ourselves. And secondly, we simply need to understand the process or the path to achieve, or the methods to achieve enlightenment. And then simply understand if we engage in these methods, then we can, in fact, achieve enlightenment. And that can overcome this discouragement, thinking that it's not possible or it's all hopeless. So these are the three types of laziness that stop us from having this joyous effort. And then if we... Oh, any questions on that, first off? I think that's sort of fairly straightforward, those three points. Okay, then if we go to the top of page 31, then we can look at what are... Here it says, gathering the forces of the favourable conditions. So here we have what's called the four powers, which are four favourable conditions or four favourable aspects that are going to support our joyous perseverance. And the first one here is the power of aspiration. So let's have a look what that means by reading through the quote there. It says, as it is said, that yearning acts as the basis for joyous perseverance. Aspiration here refers to yearning. The way to develop aspiration is to meditate on how pleasant and unpleasant effects arise from virtuous and non-virtuous karma respectively. This is because it is taught that faith acts as the basis for yearning. So here we can actually, to further this discussion, we can look at our shamatha chart handout. And if we go on to the second page there, at the top there's this table. And as we're going to see tomorrow when we look at the shamatha practice, the first fault is laziness. And so, of course, here we're talking about with respect to the shamatha practice. But, of course, as we see here, we can talk about laziness with respect to any practice. And in that table, it's got then four antidotes to laziness. And so now we are looking here, the power of aspiration. It talks about that this, that faith acts as a basis for this aspiration. So we see that in the antidotes here, that the first antidote to laziness is faith. And here, of course, what we mean by faith is faith in the practice, faith that this practice is going to bring benefit. So to overcome the laziness, the first thing we need to do, of course, is to understand what is this practice that I'm going to do, and then understand what are the benefits of this practice. And so when we see the benefits of the practice, then we're going to have a lot of faith in that practice. And that faith in the practice, as we see here in the text, is going to lead to the second antidote here, is aspiration. So again, to overcome laziness in general, then we need to understand the practice and the benefits of the practice. It's the same with everything in our life, in any activity in our life. If we see no benefit in it, we're going to be very lazy when it comes to doing that thing. So again, we need to understand the practice, the benefits of the practice, and then we'll have faith in the practice, and that will lead to aspiration here. And so as we see then in the shamatha chart, then that aspiration will lead to effort. So here, of course, we're saying that this power of aspiration is one of the favorable conditions for that joyous effort or joyous perseverance to arise. So this is the first of the four powers, this power of aspiration, this yearning, this wanting to do the practice based on understanding the benefits of the practice. Then another power that's going to help us as a favorable condition for our joyous perseverance is the second one, this power of steadfastness. So let's have a look at what that is. It says here, this means that you bring to conclusion without turning back anything at which you joyously persevere. First, do not try to do everything. Examine the situation carefully. If you see that you can do it, you engage in it. Whereas if you cannot do it, you do not engage in it. You should not even start in the first place things that you will do for a while and then discard. Committing yourself to do something, but leaving it unfinished is a hindrance to your accomplishment of other projects. So again, I think this is a very important point, is this power of steadfastness, meaning that we should look at the practice and see whether we can do the practice, and then make a commitment to do the practice and see it to completion. Otherwise, if we start things and we give up on them, then we're going to develop this habit of simply giving up on things if they get a little bit difficult. And we're never going to complete the spiritual path if we develop this attitude of simply giving up when things get a little bit difficult. Because remember, we saw one of the causes right at the beginning of this Mahayana section, one of the four causes was to persevere with hardships or difficulties in the practice. So here I think this is a very important point. And this is also something that is then mentioned within the shamatha practice. Because often in the shamatha practice, as we're going to see tomorrow, we talk about the length of sessions, how long we should meditate. And there the key phrase is quality over quantity. Much better to meditate for a short time with focus than meditate a long time simply getting caught up in dullness and distraction. But within that, it's often recommended that we, in the beginning of a meditation, we determine what we are going to do in that meditation and then complete what we determine at the beginning. So within the shamatha practice, part of that is to say, okay, I'm going to now meditate for 20 minutes, say, for example, and then complete that task. Because if we don't do that, then what often happens is on days when things are not going so well, then you're not going to have this joy, this steadfastness. You're simply going to say, oh, not going well today, I'll just stop. And then, of course, we're getting into this bad habit and we're really remaining the slaves of our mind. Our mind is dictating what we should do. And we're never going to really be able to complete things if whenever something gets difficult, we just give up on it. So this is a very important point. As it says here, is to evaluate the task and then if we determine we're going to do this task and then to have this steadfastness and see it through to the end. But there is one point more about that, which comes in the fourth power. But before we go there, let's look at the third power. And that is the power of joy. So it says here, the power of joy means that when you first engage in an activity, you do it joyfully. And once you have engaged, you have a sense of being insatiable in that you do not want to discontinue the activity. That is, you must be just as insatiable about what causes pleasurable results as about the results themselves. So this is also a very important point. Otherwise, we simply get caught up in having attachment to the result. This is going to block us. So again, this power of joy is having joy not only at understanding that the benefits that we're going to get from the practice, but actually joy in actually doing the actual practice itself. But then the fourth power is also very important, and it's the power of relinquishment. Effectively, the power of knowing when to take a rest. If you become physically or mentally fatigued from your perseverance, you must rest for a while. Otherwise, you will become exhausted and very disheartened, thereby later preventing your joyous perseverance. The above presentation shows how to joyously persevere. Do not overexert yourself. You must avoid being overly intense and being overly relaxed. So make your effort continuous like a river. So this is also very important, this power of relinquishment, in terms of when we become very tired, then we need to take a rest and not exhaust ourselves. Because if we do that, we're going to probably give up on the practice because we're going to feel it to be too difficult. So we need to pace ourselves and not overexert ourselves. So these are four powers that are going to provide favorable conditions for us to joyously persevere in our activities. Any questions about any of these four powers? Yeah.
With the power of relinquishment, how do we find that? Because we've really
but not fall back into the laziness.
So, of course, that's going to be a balance that we're going to have to strive for, and probably will take some work to find that right balance. So probably there's no easy answer to that, and rather from our own experience, we can see when we really are fatigued and when we really are just making an excuse that to be lazy.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think this sort of becomes sort of obvious the more we try to strike this balance. I think we'll get better and better at it.
I read it's like learning a musical instrument. You might get a little enthusiastic and playing, and your hands hurt and you can't even do it. You know, so you have to like song.
I think part of this, of course, is to know what our capacity is. And as the first one, the steadfastness is to look at the activity and then determine, you know, what we're going to do and how much and so forth, and then sustain that. Because remember here, we're sort of looking long-term, you know. So we need, like, long-term sustainability rather than this short, intensive burst, and then we just, you know, collapse in a heap. That's not going to work. So we need to, like it says here, like a flow of a river, you know. We need to find that balance where we can have that joyous perseverance, but, you know, not overexert ourselves so we have to give up or get exhausted. And the other, of course, extreme is just being lazy and not doing anything. So, you know, where that balance is, of course, will vary from person to person. Okay. In the shamatha, it also talks about the fourth antidote here of pliancy. So that comes out of joyous effort, that through joyous effort we have what's called pliancy, which is mental and physical flexibility, flexibility of body and mind. And that is actually what's taught in the next outline, a little bit lower, D, where it says how to use joyous perseverance to make your body, to make the body and mind serviceable. The method for using joyous perseverance to make the mind and the body serviceable is the power of mastery. So we're going to talk more about this, what this really means, in the context of the shamatha practice tomorrow. And so this then covers the fourth of the six perfections, that of joyous perseverance or joyous effort. Any questions about that before we move on to the fifth and the sixth of the six perfections? Okay. So then the fifth of the six perfections down the bottom of page 31 is the perfection of meditative stabilization, concentration. Here, actually, in the six perfections, this word meditative stabilization is actually a translation of the Sanskrit word dhyana and not really samadhi here. Uh-huh. And I'm just speculating why they, in this six perfections, why it's dhyana and not samadhi. And it could be that, remember, in samadhi, we also have the four samapattis. But they're not really a good basis for engaging in these six perfections practices, whereas the jhana certainly is. All the four jhanas and shamatha, which is an access to the jhana. So maybe that's why they've used the word jhana here rather than samadhi. But anyway, let's have a look at the practice. So it says here, meditative stabilization is a virtuous, one-pointed state of mind that stays fixed on its object of meditation without distraction to other things. So we're going to be looking tomorrow in a lot of detail in this practice. In particular, we're going to be looking at the practice of striving for the goal of shamatha, this single-pointed concentration, a mind that can focus on a single object without becoming distracted. So also here, though, we can talk about different divisions or types of meditative stabilization here in this perfection of meditative stabilization. If we look over on the top of the next page, on the top of page 32, it says, if you subdivide meditative stabilization according to nature, there are two kinds, mundane and supramundane. What that means is that if we simply have this meditative stabilization, and because of that, that will then suppress the mental afflictions, that is what's called mundane. Whereas we can also have this meditative stabilization as the basis for Vipassana practice. And then on the basis of this meditative stabilization, engage in coming to realize the nature of reality. And through doing that, then we can eliminate the mental affliction. So this is what is meant here by supramundane. So supramundane meditative stabilization is one that is used as a basis for Vipassana practice, coming to realize reality. Whereas mundane is simply used as a method for suppressing or enabling the mental afflictions to be dormant and not become manifest. Then it says, if you subdivide it according to function, there are three kinds. There is one, it says here, that stabilizes body and mind in bliss in the present life. The second one is that achieves good qualities. And the third one, that carries out the welfare of living beings. So what do these three mean? To give a short answer to this, I'll read the answer from the actual Lamrim Chenmo book. It's on page 210. And it says the following, what these three are. The first, meditative stabilization that stabilizes the body and mind in bliss within the present life is all meditative stabilizations that generate mental and physical pliancy when you enter them within equipoise, with equipoise. So this is simply talking about that when you enter into this meditative equipoise, we generate this physical and mental pliancy, which we're going to talk about tomorrow, what that really means. And through that, then we have a lot of bliss being generated in the mind. The second one, meditative stabilization that achieves good qualities is all meditative stabilizations which accomplish good qualities shared with the Shravakas. That is the super knowledges, liberations, totalities, masteries. So these are that on the basis of meditative stabilization, and I think someone asked this question earlier, that particularly on the basis of the first jhana, we can go on to develop what are called normally supernatural abilities to read other people's minds and so forth. So these are the sorts of things that are mentioned here. And also on the basis of that, we develop the ability to manipulate physical material things and so forth. So that's what's being mentioned here in this list of things as well, the masteries and so forth. The third, meditative stabilization that carries out the welfare of living beings, is meditative stabilization that accomplishes the 11 activities of others' welfare. So here we have the 11 activities again, but I don't remember. They're somewhere in the Lamrim. I can maybe chase them down and find out what the list is. I remember seeing it earlier. So they're the three types of meditative stabilization. And then I think there was a question earlier about how to practice this together with all the other six the other five of the six perfections. And down the bottom, it mentions a little bit that in the next how to practice, it says the generosity of meditative stabilization is maintaining meditative stabilization yourself and then establishing others in it. The ethics, of course, of meditative stabilization is having the right ethical motivation for engaging in meditative stabilization. And then, of course, patience is being patient when cultivating the meditative stabilization. And, of course, we need to do that joyfully. And then to conjoin it with wisdom, then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, this means that to be free of what's called the three spheres, you know, free of grasping at subject, object, agent, object, and action as independently existent. So this is the fifth of the six perfections. Any questions about that? This is a topic we're going to look at in some detail tomorrow morning.
When you said they were mundane and super mundane, is that just what they're used for? Or is like the first three mundane and you have to do the fourth one to be able to use it for Vipassana?
Yeah, so mundane, and often we, in the text, that we'll see later in that chart, the five paths, the path of meditation, often when that's explained extensively, they talk about the mundane path of meditation and the super mundane path of meditation. The mundane path of meditation is talking about this idea of developing higher and higher levels of concentration. So remember, we said that at the time of the Buddha, some of these traditions thought that higher and higher levels of samadhi was the way to liberation. So the higher and higher levels of samadhi were developed, the more and more mental afflictions are suppressed. So this is what's called here mundane path, is by developing higher and higher levels of this, we more effectively suppress, keep the lid on the mental afflictions. Whereas if we use that meditative stabilization as a basis for our vipassana practice and come to realize the nature of reality, then that mind can start to eliminate the mental afflictions. And so that's called supramundane. Yeah, exactly.
And the first jhana is good enough for that? I mean,
even shamatha is good enough, yeah. Of course, they say that the best, most stable, is the fourth jhana.
Okay.
But any of those four or shamatha is sufficient to do that, okay. to do the job. Okay. So let's look now at the sixth of the six perfections, which here, of course, is the perfection of wisdom. So here it says, of course, in general, wisdom is what thoroughly discerns the ontological status of the object under analysis. So here, as we see in the divisions of wisdom, we can have these three types of wisdom. The wisdom that knows the ultimate. So this, as it says here in the statement underneath, wisdom that knows the ultimate cognizes the reality of selflessness, either by means of a concept or in a direct manner. So here, then, what we're talking about is within this perfection of wisdom, the wisdom that knows the ultimate is a wisdom that realizes the ultimate nature of reality, how things exist. And here we see the word selflessness. In our discussion of the Vipassana practice starting tomorrow afternoon, we're going to see that here in the Mahayana, when we use the word selflessness, actually that is the same word as emptiness. Whereas earlier in the Four Noble Truths, when we talked about selflessness or no self, then we really were talking about this overinflated sense of me. Whereas here, that same word is simply another word for emptiness. So we need to keep that in mind, but I'll talk about more about that tomorrow afternoon. So here it says that this wisdom cognizes this either by means of a concept or in a direct manner. So what we're going to see, and I've already touched on this briefly earlier, is that in this practice, and in the practice of all the topics, we go through these three stages. There's Gonya come top. Tibetan words. Goal first is we gain a intellectual understanding. So, of course, here in the topic of the wisdom practice, we're talking about gaining an intellectual understanding of the idea of emptiness. Then we use that as our framework for practice. We meditate, and then in meditation, we come to have some little taste or experience of emptiness. This is nyam. But if our mind is not very stable and clear, then this experience of emptiness will only have a small impact on our mind. It may impact our mind for a little bit after the meditation, maybe a few minutes, hours, days or so, but then it'll wear off. And so what we need to do, of course, is deepen this experience so that we have a stable experience, which is tok, which is realization. And as we're going to see in the Vipassana section, to have a realization of nature of reality, we need a very stable, clear mind. We need at least the shamatha or the jhanas as a basis. And then that experience can be a realization. We will penetrate more deeply the nature of reality, and that experience will stay with us. But as it's mentioned here in the text, that this can come at sort of two levels. That is conceptual and direct. Because this idea of emptiness is a realization that there's no subject-object duality. And initially, when we start to have some taste in meditation of emptiness, there is a sense still that there's me, the meditator, experiencing this thing, emptiness. And even when we first come to realize emptiness through having in the mind of shamatha, there's still a sense of me realizing this thing, emptiness. But as we deepen that experience, then it will become a direct experience of emptiness. Meaning at that point, in the meditation, there's no sense of me, the meditator, versus emptiness, the object. There's simply the experience of emptiness. Direct, non-conceptual experience. So these are the sort of the stages that we go through in deepening our experience of emptiness. And so that's what's a little bit indicated here. So there's a question.
Yeah. Is that first stage of intellectual understanding more emphasized and considered important in the Geluk school than in the other schools of Buddhism?
Certainly in the Geluk school, there is a very much emphasis on having a very clear framework for practice. But I think in all schools, we need to have some sort of framework for practice. So it may be that in the Geluk school, they spend a lot more time in study and trying to gain this and then really go into the practice. Whereas in some of the other schools, that may be done at a more minimal level. But certainly we need some sort of framework for practice. Otherwise, when we start to have some sort of experience and we have no framework, then we won't know, well, is that a valid experience or am I just spacing out or what's going on? So, yes, it depends. From different schools, there's a different emphasis on how much here. And then also the approach to practice sometimes is also a little bit different as well. So there are, yes, these differences. But we still go through the same stages. Yeah, question.
So I've never really understood the difference between conceptual and direct, and I don't understand it anymore now.
You know, we can have, like, when we're meditating on something and then we have some little experience. When we have that experience, there's a sense that I'm having this experience.
Okay.
Isn't there?
Yeah.
Normally.
Yeah, yeah.
This is conceptual.
Okay.
And this experience of emptiness, emptiness is the realization that there is no subject-object duality, that there is no independent me and independent world.
Okay.
But when we first come to experience that, there's still a little bit that sense there that I'm experiencing the fact that there's no subject-object duality.
Uh-huh.
Whereas
but
when we
you're
get...
Still, you're still experiencing it as me.
Me okay. having the experience.
Okay.
Here,
okay.
there's no sense of me having the experience.
You're just
there's,
having a direct experience.
There's an experience. At that time, when you're in the middle of that experience, there's no sense of me completely gone. Later, when you come out, you realize I realized emptiness directly.
Ah, okay.
But in the middle of the experience, in the middle of the experience, there's no sense of me anymore.
Uh-huh. You might not even know I'm experiencing emptiness. You're just experiencing.
Correct. You're experiencing it.
Okay.
I mean, you, yeah.
Okay. I got it.
The two levels of emptiness. One is me. It's no me. And then another emptiness is it's no word. Right? It's two levels, right?
Two levels. Oh,
seven,
I thought you said
right?
labels. two levels. Yeah.
Okay,
so
two levels,
levels,
right?
Yeah.
Is
so
it the same or not? In
yes.
the direct, then you see both or...
Yeah. So I think what you're talking about is, and this is going to come up in the Vipassana section, we can talk about selflessness of person and selflessness of phenomena. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
So... To understand that, those two ideas are, depending on the philosophical school, is understand differently. So now we get a bit sort of complicated, but according to the philosophical system that we're going to look at starting tomorrow, this Majjhimika, the middle way school, when we talk about selflessness of person and phenomena, they're not two levels. In the lower school, they're levels. That selflessness of person is more coarse, selflessness of phenomena more subtle. In this school, they're not. It's not like that. When we talk about selflessness of person, selflessness of phenomena, it's saying that word selflessness is the same as emptiness. So selflessness of person and phenomena is emptiness of person, emptiness of phenomena. And whether we're talking about person or everything else, all phenomena are empty of independent, inherent existence. So these two realizations are equivalent. The only difference is, what is the thing we're focusing on to come to realize emptiness? In one case, we're focusing on me, the person, realizing emptiness on that basis. In the other case, we're focusing on the body, the mind, or some external phenomena and coming to realize emptiness. But it's the equivalent realization. It's just a different basis that we're focusing on in this school. In earlier, lower schools, there is levels. That the selfness as a person is this grasping, this overinflating sense of me, and then the selfness as a phenomena, depending on the school, is a more subtle realization. But that's a whole big topic.
Yeah, I thought for one... Bodhisattva, to become a Buddha, there is 10 steps.
10, yeah, we're going to look at that.
And then each step, there's different level of emptiness. So,
It's the same emptiness. Mm-hmm. It's the same emptiness. What is different is the power of that realization. It's not like at each of the 10 levels, they're realizing something deeper. No, it's the same realization. But what is different is the power of that realization. And the power is coming from the other side, the method side, the bodhicitta side, that makes it more powerful. But it's the same realization all the way.
I was
just, you mentioned the philosophical framework and how that's the basis, you know, to check whether or not, you know, you've had a conceptual realization or direct realization. Now, what about, I mean, I'm kind of going out on a limb here, but what about somebody that is not aware of a philosophical framework, but let's say they have, you know, not like a near-death experience, but like a death experience. They come back from this experience with this realization, like, wow, this is, like, they don't, like, how would they go about, I mean, how would you know? You know, like, how would you know that? Or
you don't.
You don't.
I mean, that's it. The bottom line, you don't. If you have no framework, and, I mean, sometimes people have valid experiences and sometimes related to nature of reality spontaneously. And then often they don't know how to interpret,
sure.
You know. And sometimes, like, people who doing, you know, like, often people go out in nature and they have this sort of oneness experience. And it feels nice. And then people go, well, what was that? You know. And then often they sort of forget about it and, oh, that was a nice thing that happened to me 10 years ago, and that's it. Or sometimes what happens is in certain types of meditation, because the mind has got very quiet, this, you know, we have now this strong sense of me and we're constantly reinforcing it on the basis of this solid body, mainly this solid body. And sometimes in meditation, when the mind gets very quiet and still, the sense of a solid body completely collapses. And then we're left in this sort of vacuum. And then there's nothing reaffirming this sense of me, because this solid sense of body has completely collapsed. And very common. And then people who have no framework for practice often at that point freak out. Because they interpret that spacious experience as going out of existence. But it's not, is it? All that's happened is that the false grasping onto me has subsided. But because they don't realize this, because they have no framework, and I've talked to a number of people who this has happened, and they've had no framework, and then on the basis of that experience, they have developed a lot of fear and anxiety and stopped practicing. But, see, the other problem here is that's one extreme with no... The other extreme, of course, is that you have this very spacious, still experience. And then you think, I've realized reality.
Right.
And then people become very delusional. So this is the other misinterpretation. And as I mentioned earlier, in the shamatha practice, you're going to have these sorts of experiences a lot. And meditation texts all warn, say, please do not, and in fact it comes up in the Lam Rim and the Vipassana section, please do not misinterpret this as a realization of emptiness or nature of reality. And it warns the meditator. In the Lam Rim it comes up. So, therefore, if we have no framework, there's a very much danger of these sorts of interpretations of experiences, and both of them can lead to not very good results. So that's why it's helpful to have a framework, and on top of that, to have a qualified teacher who you can go to. And often, as I mentioned earlier, often people have all these, because in meditation you're going to have all sorts of experiences. And often when people have these first, they get all excited and they run off to their teacher and go, oh, guess what happened to me, you know.
Yeah.
And the teacher goes, oh, boring, boring, you know. Get on with your practice, you know.
So have you heard it being possible, you know, without a framework? Is this where, when you hear about people that have experimented with psychedelics that try to shortcut the system?
Yes. Of course, with psychedelics, we can invoke or create or provoke experiences, no doubt. But, of course, a couple of things with psychedelics. One is they're not reliable. Meaning that they sometimes also provoke not good experiences. Not good experiences. They're not always provoking some blissful, spacious experience. So that's one point. And secondly, of course, is that even though you can have some experience, again, if you don't have a framework, it's difficult to interpret what that is. And, of course, often prolonged use of these substances can damage the body and the brain as well. So that's not a good thing to happen. And also, we can't really use this as a long-term vehicle because we're relying on some external stimulus. Whereas here, we need to rely on our own inner, our mind to produce this experience. Because if we're always having to rely on some stimulus to have the experience, that's not going to be very stable. So I don't know of anyone who's used psychedelics to achieve enlightenment. I know plenty of people who have experimented with psychedelics and then come to realize that maybe things are not as they previously thought, and then use that to motivate them to search in a more effective way through meditation. I know plenty of people in that way.
But I said the person that was coming to mind would be somebody like Ram Dass, where he said they started off with psychedelics and it used as a catalyst, you know, to...
Exactly. But again, I wouldn't recommend that we go out and do that because, again, there's no guarantee that you're going to have any good experience. I mean, some people have really bad trips. And secondly, of course, then some of these can really damage the brain and the body, and then some can be a little bit addictive as well. So these things are not a thing. So, of course, if we've done it, and then we can learn from that and then use a more sustainable approach like meditation. In fact, I've talked to a number of people now who, and it seems to be becoming more popular these days, to go through the shaman route, you know, the ayahuasca route. And I've talked to a number of people now who've gone into that and then believe that they can really progress a long way with that and have tried to do that and then have come to the point where they realize that this is not a long-term solution, and they've sort of let it go and have tried to come into the meditative path. So I've talked to a number of people who that is their experience. Okay. So here in this sixth perfection, then, we have the wisdom that knows the ultimate, which is this wisdom realizing the nature of reality, which is the Vipassana practice that we're going to start to look at tomorrow afternoon. Then the wisdom that knows the conventional, which it says here, the wisdom that is proficient in the five topics of knowledge, which are listed above here. That is to come to be proficient in things like grammar, logic, arts, medicine, and Buddhist knowledge. So these are some things that can help support in the spiritual path. And then, of course, the wisdom that knows how to act for the welfare of living beings. So, again, this is just the wisdom understanding how to accomplish the welfare of others. So I think that's fairly straightforward. So that is the perfection of wisdom in general. And as I said, tomorrow we're going to look at the concentration practice, particularly this shamatha practice, in some detail. And then we're also going to look at the wisdom practice, this wisdom, the Vipassana practice, wisdom realizing emptiness. We're going to look at that in a lot of detail following that. So that's starting tomorrow. So that is the summary, brief summary of the six perfections. Any questions about any of the six perfections?
The very last one was to know how to act for the welfare of other living beings. And this perfection. Is that where we get what we talk about, omniscient wisdom? You take everything into consideration all at the same time to know just the right thing to do to be of greatest benefit?
Yeah, I mean, when we achieve enlightenment, then that ability is perfected.
Right. Okay, so that's the target, though.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. I think I am. So in order to have a direct experience of emptiness, realization of emptiness,
it
requires really two things. One is the experience, and the other is the ability to properly interpret the experience through practice, experience, wisdom.
No, I mean, we don't we don't have to interpret direct experience.
Okay.
Because it's a direct experience, you know. But certainly when we have any sort of conceptual taste or experience, that we need to be able to interpret. Yeah. So there was something else in the question.
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was basically
yeah.
It, so,
yeah.
Okay.
I have a question back on page 29 about developing the patience of accepting suffering. On C, it says a detailed explanation from the viewpoint of the basis.
Where again? Page.
Page 29.
Yeah.
At the bottom of the page,
right.
C.
Yeah.
A detailed explanation from the viewpoint of the basis.
Yep.
And I kind of follow it, and then there's a part of like living by begging.
Right.
And current tasks, and I kind of get lost in there.
So, of course, remember this is probably at a time where most of the audience here are monks and nuns, and so they're getting offerings in terms of alms from other people. I think that's what it says. I think in the text here it doesn't expand much upon that, actually. And the what was the other one you said?
Current tasks.
Let me see if there's anything more in the book here about it. Page 177. Physical, worldly concerns. Oh, current tasks. It says here, you accept suffering that arises from tasks. Well, from the tasks for a household, such as faultless work. Yeah, it's just daily tasks.
Daily
activities. Here it talks about working on the farm, in business, and government employee, etc. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
So, just to maybe deal with this direct realization one more time. So, would at least some hallmark of that that if in meditation you really suddenly don't know who you are or
no.
where you are.
Well, no. That often can be confusion or dullness.
Understandably, but I mean, if the meditation doesn't fade, but suddenly there's just a thing of like, where am I? And like, even the question doesn't make sense, the whole thing, you just suddenly, none of it really matters and you can still keep meditating where you're at.
Again, just because we have an experience where there's no longer a sense of me manifest, that does not mean we've realized reality. Because in the shamatha practice, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, you are going to start to have these experiences of stillness, and there's not going to be this coarse, this grasping onto this body as me. You will start to have experiences of this sort of quite non-conceptual, spacious experiences. But just because there's a lack of grasping onto me doesn't mean that somehow we've now realized there's no independent me. There's a big difference. But anyway, I'm going to talk more about this tomorrow.
I heard that if you realize direct experience of the
Emptiness.
Buddha will come and pat on your
shoulder. I think that's a figurative thing. I think it just means that the Buddhas will be very happy if we can do that. I don't think we'll get a tap on the shoulder. Okay. Then, if we keep going on, at the bottom of, towards the bottom of page 32, it talks about this training in the four ways to gather disciples that help others to mature. So here, not only, because these six perfections practices are helping us to achieve the goal of enlightenment, but also, of course, at the same time, then we can help others to mature. And so we can do that through these four ways. These four ways to gather disciples. So let's have a look at what that means. So here then, the four are listed. The first is generosity. The second, here we see pleasant speech. Third, working at the aims. And four, consistency of behavior. So let's see what they mean. Of course, generosity here is simply in terms of material generosity for people around us. So that is basically to establish a connection with people around us. Then pleasant speech, says here, is teaching the perfections to the disciples. So then on the basis of establishing a connection with people around us through being generous, then we can start to explain the practices to them, the teachings. So that is here pleasant speech, using, of course, pleasant speech. Working at the aims, says, is setting disciples to work on the aims as they have been taught, or involving them in correctly taking up these aims. So working at the aims is then, on the basis of explaining the various practices to them, then giving them practical advice about how they individually would take up these aims, take up these practices. And then the fourth one here is consistency of behavior. It says, is stabilizing yourself in the very aims in which you have established others, and then training in them. So here, of course, we're talking about us ourselves making sure that we are implementing ourselves the practices that we are explaining to others. So what are the four benefits of these four? Or what are their four functions? We can see that down in the number three there, their functions. The first, that is being generous, they become vessels. So by being generous with them, we establish a connection with them. They become a vessel. By the second, they take interest. So through explaining the various practices and teachings to them, they take interest in the practices. And then the third, the working at the aims, by explaining how they can implement these in their own life, then they practice, the third one. And then the fourth one, the consistency of behavior, by us leading by example, then they really train, because they see that we are also engaging in these practices. So their practice really becomes a training for them. So these are what's called the four ways to gather disciples, the four ways in which we can help those around us while we are progressing towards enlightenment. So again, simply establishing connection, being generous, using pleasant speech to explain various practices to them, then giving them some more personal advice about how to implement those, and then we ourselves leading by example. So these are the four ways to gather disciples. In fact, I heard that often earlier in ancient Tibet and India is that it was fairly common that if a teacher took on a disciple, took on a person as a personal disciple, they also took on financial responsibility for that disciple. That was apparently quite common in those days. Any questions about those 4 points? I think most of that is also fairly straightforward. Okay. Then we've still got a little bit of time left, so what I'd like to do now then is give a little brief introduction into the next section. So here in the next section, you know, we've now looked at the six perfections, the practices that we need to engage in to strive for the goal of enlightenment. And remember, they can be condensed into these three core areas of ethics, concentration, wisdom. And we've talked quite a lot about ethics. And so then the other two core practices on the basis of ethics is concentration and wisdom. So here in the Lam Rim, then, now we find a very extensive presentation of these two core practices, because they were only presented very briefly in, remember, in the context of the person of medium capacity, the three high trainings, because here now they're presented in a lot of detail. And that's what we're going to spend our time now for the next 2 days, is in these two practices. So a lot to be said. So what I'd like to do now, we've got 10 or 15 minutes, is just give a brief introduction into these two practices, the last two perfections. And so here, the practice, these two perfections here is translated as serenity and insight. So serenity and insight here are translations of the two Sanskrit words shamatha and vipassana. So remember, the concentration practice, we can develop many levels of concentration of samadhi. Here in the Mahayana, the very much is emphasized the first level of concentration, the level of shamatha. So often then, the concentration practice here is often just called shamatha practice, which is translated here into English as serenity. Probably more commonly, this is translated into calm abiding, because shamatha we can divide into shama and ta. Shama means really calm, and ta means to abide. And that literally, directly translated into Tibetan, is shinne. Shi means calm, ne means to abide. So shinne, or calm abiding. Here, translated as serenity. And here then, insight is a translation of vipassana, Sanskrit word. Of course, in Pali, that is vipassana, but same word. So again, here, the V-I means higher or beyond. Pashana or pashana means to see. So vipassana means to see beyond or higher seeing. So often translated into English as something like special insight, or here simply insight. So of course, when we talk about vipassana or vipassana practice, there are many types of insight we can cultivate in the path. And we saw that in the person of medium capacity striving for nirvana, then in the modern day, or in the traditions, the Theravada traditions, when they talk about this practice, vipassana practice, they talk about three insights, the three marks of existence, which we looked at briefly earlier, was to develop the insight into impermanence, dukkha, and no self. So what you'll find these days, someone in the Theravada tradition, such as Sri Lankan Buddhism, Burmese Buddhism, Thai, Cambodian, generally when they talk about vipassana practice, they're mainly talking about trying to cultivate these three insights: impermanence, dukkha, no self. Whereas here in the Mahayana, when we talk about vipassana practice, then of course that can include all of those three. But more importantly, when we talk in vipassana practice here, we're talking about the insight into emptiness. So here, vipassana practice is the realization of emptiness. Which in Sanskrit is shunyata. So again, generally in the Mahayana, when someone talks about vipassana practice or insight practice, we're talking about gaining an insight into emptiness or shunyata. again, that this means that everything is empty of independent existence. Nothing exists independently. And as we said before here, then often when we do this investigation, then we can divide up everything into two classes of phenomena. We can divide it into person and phenomena. So therefore, and there is a reason for doing that, and I'll explain more about that later. So then we can talk about the emptiness of the person and the emptiness of phenomena. Phenomena there means everything other than person. And here, in this level of practice, emptiness is synonymous with selflessness. That in this system, when we see the word selflessness, that means emptiness. In other philosophical systems in Buddhism, these are not equivalent. In fact, in a lot of the Theravada traditions, you normally don't see this word at all. You'll only see selflessness or no self. So we need to understand that depending on the philosophical system, then there are differences in what these words mean. But here, what we're going to be following tomorrow, beginning tomorrow afternoon, emptiness, or shunyata in Sanskrit, is the same meaning as selflessness. And here we can relate to this in terms of emptiness of the person and emptiness of phenomena, which is everything other than person. But this is an equivalent realization. It's just a different basis that we're using to do the investigation. But anyway, more about that comes tomorrow. Yeah?
Is a person any mental continuum, any sentient being?
A person is defined as having normally the five aggregates, but in the formless realm, there's no form aggregate, so there's four aggregates. But person is defined...
Like animals?
Yeah. So any of the beings in the six realms are person. Yeah. Basically having body and mind. Although in the formless realm, there's not really a coarse physical body.
When they do Vipassana in Theravada, you mentioned that three things they should... Are those in any ways prerequisites in some ways or helpful for us?
Absolutely. Do? Absolutely helpful, for sure. We're not going to go into it here, but... when we look at the nature of reality in much more detail, we can see that actually there are sort of four philosophical systems that evolved in ancient India based on the various teachings of the Buddha. And within those four philosophical systems, then we can see that each one is sort of like building on the previous one. And so that actually it's helpful to understand the earlier systems to build. So here then, the idea of realizing impermanence is actually very helpful for this. In fact, in some texts, it says that if we really can realize impermanence directly, we're this close to realizing emptiness.
All right.
Because normally now, when we intellectually think about impermanence, you know, things are changing moment by moment. Normally we have this idea that there's a thing in this moment that in the next moment becomes something else. No? That we have this point that there is a thing.
A continuity of objects, like they say.
Yeah, that there is an object that changes to another object in the next moment. But is that really what impermanence means? I mean, is there a static object in a moment?
No, it undercuts the framework.
Yeah, exactly. So this can't be what we mean. Yeah. There is no one thing that in the next moment changes into another thing. That would undercut the whole idea of impermanence. Yeah. So what we can understand is that there's just change always happening. So there is no thing we can point to anywhere in there, can we? Mm-hmm. Which is emptiness. So it's said that if we can really realize impermanence, we're very close to realizing emptiness. Very close.
Only one lifetime away.
Okay. So here then, if we look at the down a little bit from the top of that, the last two perfections, the nature of serenity and insight. After you have quelled the distraction to external objects, you rest in a delighted and pliant mind. So hear this word pliancy, which we're going to look at tomorrow morning, which naturally and continuously engages an internal object of meditation. This is called meditative serenity. So this is what shamatha is. While you remain in serenity, any analysis on that very object is called insight. So this is vipassana practice. And then it goes on to talk about the etymology of serenity and insight, which we've already just covered here on the board.
And insight means realization?
Yeah. So as we're going to see, actually, in fact, we can go down now to look at that, where it goes down how to be certain about their order. If you have not attained serenity, then no matter how much analytical meditation you do with discerning wisdom, in the end, you will not be able to generate delight and bliss of physical or mental pliancy. Once you have attained meditative serenity, then even the analytical meditation of discerning wisdom will culminate in pliancy. Hence, insight requires meditative serenity as a cause. So what this means is that if we want to have realization, then we need that shamatha as a basis. Because we can talk about three levels of meditation. We have what's not three levels of meditation, three levels of wisdom. We can have the wisdom arisen from hearing, the wisdom arisen from contemplation, and the wisdom arisen from meditation. To have the wisdom arisen from meditation is when we generate realization on the basis of shamatha. That, as briefly here it said, and we're going to see in more detail in the Vipassana section, is that when our shamatha mind can then unify with the Vipassana investigation, when they become unified, then we have realization, we have the wisdom arisen from meditation. But there's more to be said about that in the text. If you want to read a bit about more about that, it really comes on the last page of your outline. There's a lot of information there if you want to read about it now, but we're going to come to it later in the Vipassana section. So this is what we're going to be covering now for the next 2 days. So tomorrow, of course, we're going to start with the shamatha practice, which starts here in the middle of page 33, and it goes on to the end of page 37. So hopefully we can cover most of that tomorrow morning. And then tomorrow afternoon we are going to start to look at the Vipassana practice. So 39, 38, 39, Yeah, I'm probably not going to get much past that. Yeah, so maybe if you want to read a little bit about 38 and 39. So that's the subject for tomorrow. And then the following day, we're going to basically then finish the rest of that. So more or less to the end of your booklet the following day. Okay. Any last question before we finish the day? Enjoy your meditations, and I'll see you tomorrow morning.